Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Hello, welcome back, everybody, to another year of the Sandy Podcast.
I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Back in 2025 for our fifth season. You can expect more of this.
He's claiming that he was ill before the semifinal, whatever. But, you know, I just feel like at that point he was just looking for attention.
And some of this.
Andrew normally say, no human is limited. So I can't limit myself, or I can't just say I can do.
As well as event coverage around all the major races on the UK circuit.
And if you're a fan of the pod, please give us a rating and review on your preferred podcast streaming service.
And if you want to stay up to date with all the latest news, give us a follow on Instagram at Sunday Podcast.
As always, thanks for listening. See you next time. And we hope you enjoyed the episode.
Hello, guys. Welcome back to another episode brought to you by sportshoes.com. As always, Steve Jones on the podcast today. Absolute legend of the marathon game as we approach the big one and the marathon not too far away at all. But just before we get into the episode with Steve, I just thought we'd round up a few results. Obviously, had a few road races around the globe recently as well.
We have indeed, mate. And obviously, Boston Marathon on Easter Monday. So, yeah, be watching that. Looking forward to it. Kelly Thackeray goes in that one. But, I guess like European road running last weekend. And one result for me just stands out in particular. And that's George James in the marathon. Like, kind of out of nowhere, this guy runs 2:10. His PB previously was 2:14. Or 2:11, actually, ran in Frankfurt in the October. And like a 65 half. Had done very little. And did a 69 half. And I think he did do that in New York as well. A bit baffled there. But he's a new name for a lot of us, George James. And I mean, we saw him on the selection as well. And we didn't give him kind of much airtime at all. Didn't expect him to come fourth. And in a race where Ioane and Ayeli and Teferi and basically the top three, top four, their average lifetime best is 2:05. You know, the winner, the Italian, 2:06 was his PB. Second place and the second and third place, their PBs were 2:04. And fourth place, his PB is 2:06. And George James comes in there and finishes fifth right behind these guys in 2:10. And you think if he, and the course was not fast either. You know, it was, I don't think it was as tough as the Olympic marathon course, but it was a slow course. It was hilly. It was undulating, and the fact that Gressier ran as fast as he did, sub 60 and a half marathon, was mind-boggling. He is absolutely flying right now. And then obviously he announced he was going to do steeple. I'm digressing, but yeah, Gressier was very exciting. Yeah, George James is a name to look out for, and you think going into like London, I mean, one, how many men will go quicker than what he ran, 2:10:10, in, I hope, a lot, but you know, with Emil and obviously Mark Scott, that news, he's now not racing, but you know, that's a time where I'm even like, is Alex Yee even going to run like 2:10?
Yeah, it's an unknown, right, isn't it? And I think just on George James, obviously outstanding run from him. He is someone that has really, for me, like capitalized on that, I guess, fund your own way. And we've kind of had a discussion last week around whether it should or shouldn't be. But look, that's the case right now anyway. But he is someone that's
just done that.
There's no way they're picking him if it wasn't fund your own way.
Yeah.
Whereas he's someone who has obviously like got selected because they're taking a bigger team. He's then made that gamble, made the decision to fund his own way there, and it's paid off for him. And I hope he kind of sees gets that money back is what I mean to say, kind of now, by kind of getting into some better races and that sort of thing. But fabulous run from him. And like you say, yeah, we didn't give him much airtime at all kind of going into it, but proved us wrong for sure. Like, brilliant race.
And just on that, to be fair, that fund your own way, I've heard that it was only about, I think BA asked for between £70 and £100. I don't know the exact figure, but it was very, very minimal in the end. I think it was up to, that they could ask for up to £1,100, but that definitely wasn't the price that people had to pay to go and represent there. And so I think that they offset quite a bit of it anyway. But yeah, so it was minimal pay. And I would much rather full teams go to events. That's the big thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
So there we go. And then just a few more results from that, from the half marathon. Like I said, Gressier was just, that was the marathon that we just summarized, but Gressier was just an absolute animal in the half.
And the Steve Ocello, like you said.
Yeah, mate, and the steeple. Yeah, the guy wants to do steeples. I can't wait to see what he can do. And another person I think is going to be running steeple next year is that Stefan Nilsson. Guy ran 330, 331 in the Olympic Games. Dutchman and sort of surprised and finished sixth. I think he was sixth in the Olympics, wasn't he? Something like that. But in fact, I guess we'll kind of gloss over the half because we didn't have anyone in it. But let's go. Ellis Cross continues to show really good form, finishes 12th in the 10K, just a couple seconds behind Nordas. Again, in a pretty strong field, but fair to say we would have liked a little bit more from, I think Rory Leonard had a tough couple of weeks with that sound 10. But you know, when you're running 27:40, just inside that marker, you'd want to be finishing higher than 14th in a European 10K where there's still a lot of athletes missing.
Yeah, mate. I think, again, talk about us previewing events. We kind of bigged it up as the guys going in there and trying to medal, and I'm sure they were. But yeah, like you said,
caliber too. Like they yeah. like Mike Foppen was finishing eighth. Like they would beat Mike Foppen in a 10K. I think like pound for pound of their 100%. I think they had the caliber to finish much higher up.
Do you think it's? Do you think that one of the issues is that we, as a nation at the moment, our 5K, our 10K guys, like but to say this crop of athletes, so Ellis Cross, Rory Leonard, Charlie Wheeler, and Manthorpe, even throw him in there, that the level they're at now, they're so like on the cusp that they're having to like take a bite of every bit they can get here and there. Like you say, like Rory Leonard's had a bit of like a heavy few weeks of racing. And they almost have to accept every opportunity and they almost have to try and put themselves in every race to kind of get the big one that almost takes them to the next level. Where you mentioned Mike Foppen, because he's so like accepted set in his like national team, in his national setup, he can really pick and choose where he goes throughout the season. And he knows that like he's going to get in on like rankings or something like that. It's not going to be like you need a qualifying time. And
I think, you know, I think off the back of Valencia, I think there was a reason why the likes of, I mean, Scott Beattie even did the mass race and worked his way up. And his performance is, I guess, hard to judge too much because I know he had to like battle through a lot of people and go quite aggressive at the start. But they targeted this race, I think, because actually it was a realistic shot of really punching, like getting a top five finishing spot, or, you know, definitely a top eight. Like I think realistically, I don't think they would have gone there had you said, oh yeah, they're going to finish, you know, just crack the top 20 or something like that. You know, I mean, Leonard was top 10 at the European Cross. I think he would have, and that had people like Almgren in there. It had people like Jakob in there. Like I would probably say that top 10 at the European Cross was much stronger than the top 10.
Yeah.
In Brussels. So I think they've gone there and it's a race where they can really put themselves on the map and sort of cement themselves as kind of top European athletes. But I guess it's very, very difficult coming off of that sound 10 on the track. I don't think anyone ran the sound 10 and then came to Brussels, except them. Tough position for them to be in. And I think, yeah, they're just going to regroup. The tricky thing is as well, is like, do they now get ready for the 10 in, you've got 8 weeks or maybe just under that. I think it is about 8 weeks until the British 10,000.
Yeah. But that's what I mean, mate. So like, since November, like, I'm just double checking Leonard's results now, right? So he runs Liverpool in November ill. And it's obviously just a tough run regardless, but that's going to take even more out of him. Then turns it around and has that insane run at Europeans in December. January, he's running the British record in Valencia. February, he's running an indoor in Boston. Then he's running in March a 10K on a track. And then April, he's not run that European champs 10K. Where's the like... I'm not saying... look, that's what I mean. The stage that in his career, he almost has to... I think that these events are too tempting not to do. But if you think about obviously other end of the spectrum, like Mo Farah's never doing that race schedule, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess.
Or Grant Fisher's never doing that schedule.
Yeah, they're racing more, but in a short period of, you know, in a much shorter period of time to hold that peak for that long is difficult. Yeah, I think you have a good point there. Yeah, you really do. I think fair play. But yeah, that was, I guess that was the men's 10. We obviously had a few more in there. Charlie Wheeler, 21st, just outside the top 20 for him. Alfie Manthorpe, 33rd. And, you know, I think Logan Rees and Scott Sterling would definitely be kind of looking at that. And they got close at the trial race in Pulford. They beat Manthorpe. And yeah, I think to sort of difficult to pick teams off of a Valencia 10K, isn't it? When the race is, we always said that, when the race is 4 months down the line. Hey ho.
I guess the thing with Manthorpe though is like he, I think fair play to him because he turned up to the trial and just made sure he finished in the spot. So like he knew he had the time. So he was like, well, I don't need to go with these guys. And
yeah, so. He did. And then on the women's side, Verity Ockenden, our first woman home, 11th. I'm sure many of you have seen this. Beth Potter was 14th, 32-16. Again, I was hoping for more from Potter. I really was. The way she's been running, you were like, could she? She was kind of another one. Can you crack sort of top eight, top five? Yeah, she was in. I thought she was in going to be in much better form than that. But again, I think for these
triathletes,
their racecraft is, I mean, we call Potter a triathlete. Obviously, she had a great start in the sport when it came to distance running as well. But their ability to race, I think, is relatively weak. Because, you know, they're just in a triathlon, it's like you just get everything out of yourself. You get as much out of yourself as possibly can. You never really have to think. You just push.
You would hope so, though. Do you know what I mean? And the same with Yi, right? I'd be a bit concerned if some of these athletes come and start. I expect them to run well, but I'd be a bit concerned if, like, they came and won or medaled here. Because then I'm like, well, why are people just running? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's it. Yeah, actually.
Up against, like, pure distance runners who are purely training to be an elite professional runner rather than trying to do three disciplines. Don't get me wrong, triathletes are insane. I have a lot of respect. But I'd be a bit concerned if they started like on an international level. Like we see on a domestic level sometimes, but on an international level, I'd be a bit concerned if they start beating the runners.
Yeah, you would be. But for someone who ran 31:15 at Pulford about 3 weeks prior, I was kind of hoping for a little more from her. But again, I think you're right. It does show you that. Well, it's telling us what we already know, mate. Times and not everything, and actually your ability to race is far more important. And obviously,
Betsy's one of the best in the world, and she's only on 31:10. So you then on this relatively course, speaking.
Yeah. Well, it was quite controlled early on, and then obviously they sort of just dropped the hammer. It was a twisty course, poor conditions, and a little bit hilly as well. So yeah, I do appreciate that, but again, there wasn't too many who were 31:15 runners in that field. So then Phoebe Anderson, Lee Quirk, they were down in the 30s, and Sarah Astin, 36th, and then Jenny Nesbitt, 47th. So that crowned off the British team. So again, I think we would have liked to try and really contend a little bit more. But anyway, it's pretty much the European Road Running Champs, mate. We'll quickly preview this Boston Marathon field because, yeah, it's a great field lined up. We've got people like Evans Chebet, two-time champion. Women's field, we've got Helen O'Beary, who's obviously defending champion. She's going for her hat-trick of wins, actually. On the women's field, we've got Kelly Hager Thackeray, who could crack. I think she could run a PB, of 2:21:34 in Berlin. It'll be, yeah, I guess Boston is a tough course, but there is just a lot of fast women there. And, you know, if she's going to have a big run, I think. Her halves have looked very good. She's run 66 for the half in this build. And yeah, she could be in a place where she breaks 220. And the only thing with Boston is like, there's no pacers, but I think that's what we talk about. Yeah. We spoke with Steve Jones and his views on pacers, you know, and he hardly had any pacers. It was all just gun to tape sort of work. And that's the only thing with Boston is it can be slow at the start. And if it is slow, you kind of, those fast times go out the window. But I think Thackeray's definitely in sub 220 shape or in around that 220 shape ballpark. But delivering it on Boston is definitely one thing. And look, I think O'Beary's won Boston in about 2:21 the last couple of years anyway. So the women, just quickly scan through that women's field. You got Bariso, who's 2:14:58, basically 2:15 runner. Five women sub 2:20. Edna Kiplagat is one of those though. De Matteo, who's obviously now 40 as well, is one of those, the American. Sarah Hall's doing it. Emma Bates, obviously Helen O'Beary, you just think heavy favorite on that women's side. Men's side, Lemma, who won last year, John Career, he's 202 man from Chicago. Evans Chebet has also won Boston a couple times. Mateko, who 204 man from Valencia, 26:50 on the track a couple times. Kenyan 10,000 meter champ, he's doing it. Yeah, Abel Kipchumba, remember him? And then obviously the Americans are all hyping up Conor Mance. They're getting ready to see Conor Mance either take the win or get on the podium, which would be special. And he's certainly in great form, isn't he, with his 59 halves, a couple of 59 halves. But I do just look at that field and I'm like, you know, I think, I don't think we'd be expecting, for example, like Emil is like our equivalent of Conor Mance, and he's, you know, technically he's better than Conor Mance. Well, he is better than Conor Mance in the marathon. There's no doubt about it. Would we be expecting Emil to podium in London? I know he did last year, but a lot of people dropped out. But like, yeah, I don't know if it would. London's felt stronger anyway, so.
I think we probably would be getting excited, wouldn't we? So, you can't blame the Americans for that, because Conor Mance, similar to Emil, is such an exciting athlete, like regardless of like whether it's realistic for him to win or to medal.
Yeah.
I think he's just such an exciting athlete to watch that everyone's almost willing him to the podium or win. Particularly, I'm sure if we're American, we'd be the same. And I think it's the same with Emil. Like everyone, every he's lining up on a start line. Every Brit's looking at that race and thinking, yeah, he can do this, and they're really willing him on. And I think with Mance, it's similar.
Yeah. So look, Boston, watch it on Monday. We're certainly excited for it, and we will do a quick review of Boston. Obviously, that'll be in our big London preview early next week, as we preview the London Marathon, all the Brits involved in that. And of course, yeah, the big announcements, no Emil and no Mark Scott, which is a big shame. But mate, I think just before we get into this Steve Jones episode, it's worth talking about the Diamond League is obviously back next week, and the events they've got, you know, considering Diamond League are now rivaling Grand Slam, and they really are. Diamond League have put out some, I guess, you know, posts with intent to sort of showcase what they've done for the sport. And I think they put up a post with loads of numbers the other day, like saying we've handed out over X amount of millions in prize money, and we've had X world records, and we've had X Olympic medalists compete in our sort of competition, our series, which I thought, yeah, obviously they're trying to grab the attention of those people who are getting excited about Grand Slam. But I don't think they're going about it the right way. In this Diamond League, we've got a 1,000-meter race for the women. Faith Kipyegon's doing it. She'll probably run the world record. 28.9 is the world record, by the way.
That is classic track meet organisers, though, isn't it? Just being like, oh, we'll put on a random event. That will make the sport exciting.
Why? You know, Grand Slam are putting on proper events, and they're making the best run head-to-head. And instead, we're going to have to watch Faith Kipyegon and a bunch of other women run 1,000 metres. And I'm just like, don't care. 300-meter hurdles for men as well, which they've now introduced and they've changed. So then it's just like, where's the relevance? Like, that is bizarre. That decision is bizarre. 300-meter hurdles for men. I think you're going to have a lot of 400 hurdlers just turn around and say, why would I do that? I want a 400-meter hurdle race. You know, they probably do 300 hurdles in training. And I think the result is, I don't know what the result's going to be like, but I expect it could be quite a lot different, because that extra 100 in a 400 hurdles race is everything. Like that's where the best deliver. Mm. That's where they come through. So I just feel like, yeah, there've been some rogue decisions. There are some, we have got a men's 3,000 meter steeplechase, thankfully. Yeah, we look forward to watching that. It's absolutely stacked. Actually, there's a load of good men in there. No Brits though. And we have got a women's 5,000 with Beatrice Chebet and Gudaf Segei both doing it. So, I mean, two of the best 5,000 meter runners in the world, Barkie Diagon, in that one. So them two are going to go head to head for the first time at the end of April. But yeah, that's, I guess, it is early, and Diamond League are probably thinking we'll get to our business events later in the season. Maybe it's quite nice for an early season Diamond League to have these different events, but
I want to see what they roll out for pre. That'll be the test. That'll be how they really try and compete, particularly
how they
on
jazz it up and
US soil as well. Yeah, but we will see.
Yeah, they need to really deliver, you know, pre classic. I mean, pre classic is always special.
That's
isn't
one
it?
Way, which is like you say, yeah, it's always.
Yeah. Talking of that, mate, I think London Diamond League, we've sold 50,000 tickets already, plus probably by now. And Kerr is going to face Jakob on home soil over the 1500. So if you want to watch that in July, get your tickets now, because I think there's only a few thousand left. Josh Kirby, Jakob Ingebrigtsen, and that will be a good matchup. Right, mate, let's get into Steve Jones.
Yeah, absolutely. What a talk, mate, because we've wanted to do this one for a long time, and Steve really went into some detail about his career, about his training, and just his general approach to being an elite runner, I think was the main thing. And
look, the guy ran 2.7 several times. It really does put into perspective, you know, we're here, I mean, still, I think, what, Emil Mofara are quicker than this guy. Mohamed, I think, has gone quicker than him as well. But very, very marginally, like minimal. You know, even Emil's like 2.06 high, isn't he? So, you know, they've hardly gone quicker than this guy. He was a trailblazer. He was a world record holder at the time. And it does put into perspective all this Morton, all this fueling, this and that, which is obviously very, very important. And you can't compete in this day and age. But yeah, he was doing incredible things on the resource that he had. And, you know, I think the fundamentals were, you know, he'd love to call his sort of running, sort of steady running or whatever, but you know, it does later transpire that he was basically running marathon pace almost every single day on his easy runs. Yeah. Or there would be a large chunk of his so-called easy runs in brackets, marathon effort, and, you know, just an incredibly hard worker. And I think that is, you know, that is the basics. He wasn't that injury prone either. He was able to stay healthy. But I think with the marathon, in, you know, it's clear from what he said is you can overcomplicate a lot. You know, it's basically just lots of running and actually just lots of hard running. And that will get you a good marathon, according to Steve Jones. So I'm sure many will have different opinions, but it was cool to see his take.
We'll let Steve do the talking. This one's quite a long one, so enjoy. And we'll catch you guys very, very soon. Okay, perfect. Steve, first off, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate it. Welcome to you. And well, we want to start with, we kind of just mentioned just off air about some of the rumors about your career that always came out. But one that I guess always stuck with myself and Matt, particularly when we were running at university, was the pints before the world record, right? And we want to dive straight in there. And how many pints actually was it? Because I've seen multiple different articles on this. Everyone used to say different things. Was it actually any pints that went down before that half marathon world record in Birmingham?
Yeah, there was a couple of pints. Actually, we were at a wedding in Ghost Island the day before, Ali Cole's wedding, and they had Strongbow on draft. So we had a couple of pints of Strongbow. It probably wasn't as many as was rumoured. There's been rumours of 10 pints, 8 pints, probably about 6 pints of cider, probably. That set me up grand for the next day, isn't it?
Yeah, that's very good going still.
That was a light night.
How did those 20... I think because it's a fascinating story because... When me and Ollie were at university, that's the first time we heard about you. Some of the lads, we went to university in Cardiff, some of the lads there, whenever we went on a night out, they would justify it and they would always bring up that story. I think as fresh as we first heard of it then, and it stuck throughout the whole of university.
I hope it's worked for them. They're bragging about it for me. That it's not something I would recommend everybody to do, but you know, we were at a wedding and the next day was, I think it was a 3-8 half marathon, I think, in Birmingham. And it was just another race. I wasn't going out to break a world record. I was going out to race whoever was there. World records are funny things that they either happen or they don't, you know, and they usually happen when you least expect it, you know. So I knew I was fit. I knew I could run hard. I had a little bit of a headache, and it was a late night and an early morning to drive up to Birmingham from Frantwick Major, but we made it, got there and raced. And I was as surprised as anybody else with the finishing time.
Yeah. And look, obviously that's one story, but I think it's fair to say your career in general, was it quite rock and roll? You know, you mentioned that's somewhat of a light night for you back in the day, but do you almost look at today's pros and think, what are they doing? Like, obviously there's an element that they need to do it, but the times people are running now are not so far away from what you were running back in the 80s, and particularly before Super Shoes. You could argue there was almost no difference at all.
Yeah, you could argue that. Most people will. I think you have to go way back to where we started. When I say we, my generation started. You know, we were 14, 15, 16 years of age, wearing the Woolworths Adidas. You know, the sport has moved on, and we trained and raced with the times. You know, that's what we had at those times. You know, the SL72s or Tiger Cub road shoes. It's way technology has taken over, I suppose. What I'm trying to say, training methods have become more scientific. Yeah, scientific is a clean way of explaining it, I suppose. Yeah. Another thing to realize is that you're training to achieve a bar, trying to get to a bar. And our bar was there, you know, and you know, I talk, say I was, you know, Nick Rose, myself, Tony Simmons, Bernie Ford, you know, the kind of runners that were my heroes, I suppose, when I first started. And they set the bar, and I always try to achieve that bar, you know, whether it's the club record, whether it's the road race record, whether it's the world record, you know, you try, you're aiming for that bar. Of course, over the years, the bar has gone up and up and up and up, but it's still the same philosophy. Yet everybody's still trying to achieve equivalent of what the bar is today. And the training methods have changed, more scientific, more technique. Obviously, the shoes have changed as well, which has made a huge difference. So I'd say most of us would be on par with what's happening today if we were in this situation or in today's sporting world.
Mm. It's funny, you say the training's changed. And was there a period when you sort of hung up your spikes or your road shoes and you look back on sport, was there a period where we went a little bit soft, like late 90s, early 2000s? Because I feel like as much as the training's changed, it's almost got back to the levels of what you guys were doing. If it's all right with you, are you able to just recall exactly what training you were doing to become a world record holder in the marathon at the time?
Yeah, they're not easy questions, you know. I think what's changed more than anything else is recovery. The amount of time people spend recovering from workouts, which is why they can do 3 or 4 workouts a week of quality work, was we couldn't do that, mainly because we were working 40 hours a week. You know, we had full-time jobs, we had families to raise. So we had to be, we had to manage our time almost as diligently as we managed our training, I suppose. Whereas today, a lot of people are sponsored, whether it's private sponsors, whether it's corporate sponsors, whether it's shoe sponsors, or whether it's the Athletic Federation is sponsoring them or providing them with a stipend. The 40-hour week working for a living doesn't apply today. Not to the guys at the very top. You know, there's a second tier that's trying to achieve that. I still believe they've mastered the art of recovery. How they do that is sometimes questionable because it's not just a matter of putting your feet up and resting for 2 hours in the afternoon. There's other recovery actions going on, which are rumors anyway. Not that I want to take anything away from anybody today. It's just that it's mind-boggling to me and to my generation to see how fast some people are running, you know, and whether they're 18 years of age or 42 years of age. It's amazing to see how the record books have changed over the years, how fast people are running. And it can't all be the shoes and it can't all be the recovery. So it's the managing everything, I suppose.
So to clarify,
I don't know if that answered your question.
No, I just wanted to clarify as well. You were working a full-time job when you were running 207, 208 in a marathon, marathon majors.
Until 1988, I left the Air Force in 1988. And then in 1990, we moved here to Boulder, Colorado. Yeah.
Wow, and that was 40 hours a week.
Yeah, and sometimes more because I worked on a team. And when I'm away, somebody had to, in the Air Force, and when I was away, somebody had to pick up my slack that I was leaving. So whenever overtime came, we needed to get aircraft out of the hangar in a couple of days, or we needed to change some components and it would require overtime, then I would always, much to my wife's annoyance, I would always volunteer straight away because I was being let to go to, you know, like a Friday afternoon to get up to Crystal Palace for a track race, to go down to Sutton Coldfield for the road relays or something like that, you know. So, and also running for the Air Force, Wednesday afternoons would be sports afternoons. So it took Wednesday morning to get to the venues and stuff like that, you know. So I was getting a fair bit of time off, but also I was putting in time in lieu. So it could have been 40 to 60 hours, you know, all depending on what needed to be done.
So around that then, around, I guess, a huge working week, and it's not like you're just sat at a desk at a computer either. You're actually out there doing things, doing physical things as well. What would training look like? Are you able to talk us through kind of like a typical week in terms of mileage and specific sessions as well?
Well, my typical week never changed throughout my whole career, except there was a winter typical week and a summer typical week, depending on coach's outlook for what his expectations for the year would be, or for the winter or for the summer. Then in the winter, sometimes we would do a hard workout on Monday. Depending, in several years, we did it on Tuesday. So we'd be doing 3 workouts a week. We do Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, or Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. It all depended on his perspective on where we were going, what kind of work we needed to do, and what kind of recovery we needed after the Sunday run. So obviously, Sunday, a long run. Monday or Tuesday, hard workout. Wednesday, we weren't into semi-long runs at that point, but Wednesday could be two runs, you know, 6 and an 8, or or 2 sixes or something. Thursday hill workout, and it could be anything, anywhere from a 2 minute hill to a 45 second hill to a 2 minute hill. Friday, another longish kind of run, maybe 13 miles or something, mainly recovering from the hill workout. And Saturday would be a grass workout. So Sunday again, long run. So all through the winter, that would be our program. And even the program is 6 weeks in advance, so we had 6 weeks to follow. I put it up on the fridge, look at it, see what I needed to do. And over the years, I didn't even need to look. I just
yeah.
I knew Mondays was this, I knew Tuesdays was that. So he was very old school, very old school. So he stuck to the basics of running. Didn't have to tell me how fast to run. Hard workout was a hard workout. Steady run was a steady run. An easy run was an easy run. Not that I ever remember too many easy runs, but it's funny. Out here now, a lot of distance running, I suppose, on distance runners, they have a tempo run midweek or Thursday or sometimes on Friday. Whereas I think all my runs were tempo runs. So I was getting something out of every run. There was never any sit back on your heels and drag your backside around. It was always out the door and let's go. I mean, probably why I trained better when I was on my own, because I didn't have to worry about anybody else.
What do you mean by that last comment? You trained better on your own because you didn't have to worry about anyone else. Is that because you would get competitive or you'd have to run at their pace?
Yeah, I would always get the blame, so I feel bad then. I'd get home, I'd probably kill him or something. But no, I did enjoy running by myself. Occasionally, we would meet up, especially out here, we would meet up and do a set of fives or a track workout on a Thursday night. For the most part, I did a lot of my stuff by myself. And even when I was in the Air Force, there was always one person, sometimes two people that would jump in with a run with me. But the workouts themselves, I always did by myself, whether it's set of fives, set of threes, set of twos, hills or whatever, I did by myself.
Is that how you enjoyed the sport, or is that a decision you made to get to the highest level?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I don't think there was ever a time or ever a workout I didn't enjoy doing, You might have dreaded it, but once you got out there and put your daps on, you were flying up the hills. Yeah. When I first started coming through, let's say 1977, 78, I remember I was at RAF Lynham, and I was working continental shifts. We were on A flight B line. We'd have day shifts, afternoon shift, and night shift. And on the night shifts, I'd be out running down the lanes, and because that was supper time, so I'd go, it was like lunchtime really, but it was supper time on night shift, and I'd envision Brendan Foster and Carlos Lopez side by side. We're doing these 5 minute efforts. All my efforts were timed to minutes. There was no like miles or 600 or 200 or 800. It was all done by minutes. And all I could see is a light. It'd be probably a mile away. And I'd have Carlos and Brenda not right on by one each side of me, and visualizing, just starting to pull away from them. And that's the sort of thing that helped me move to the next step, the next level, and the next level. It's all about getting to different levels and changing your training year after year, So we're basically doing the same recipe, but adding more miles, going from 75 miles to 85 miles and from 85 to 95. And this was an annual progression. It wasn't like a 3 monthly progression. It was an annual progression. Because 76, I was still 20, 21. So there's no need for me to be doing 80, 90, 100 miles a week.
In terms of like that progression, did you grow up wanting to be the best in the world or a world record holder, or was it simply, like as you say, just trying to always get to the next level in running?
It's world records, they don't enter your mind. It's like, tell me what makes me smile is when you're watching the Olympics and somebody shoved the mic in somebody's face, and besides thanking the Lord, you say, I've dreamt about this all my life. Nobody dreams about that. That's a fallacy. It happens. It just happens, okay, you might get to a certain level where you think, I might be able to make that team. But you're not, you know, you're not, you're up there with a positive and realistic chance of making that team. You're not down here dreaming about it. You're down here thinking, how am I going to beat that son of a gun next week? You know, I'm going to get my times a little faster. I want to beat that guy in front of me. You know, he's been beating me for 3 weeks now, and I beat him 4 weeks before that for a week. To me, it was about beating a guy in front of me. And then the guy in front of him. And it actually worked. Mm. It actually worked. And there was no, I remember running 16 minute 5Ks for Swindon AC. I ran a 9:55, 2 miles. And I thought I was going great until I realized it was just two sub 5 minute miles. So in my career is, I'm the quintessential club runner that came good.
Mm. Mm. It's interesting you mentioned about training to time and training alone, and then talking about, you know, that sort of race mindset you had. Do you think training to time and training alone, where you weren't obsessing over splits and what shape you were in and this and that, you had more time to, like you said, visualize races and actually get competitive against yourself and train that side of you to then get competitive against others? Whereas if you're looking at the watch all the time, you kind of lose that element to the sport.
Yeah, of course you do. It's the only time I wore a watch is when I did a workout, you know, because I needed, you know, when's 5 minutes up, when's 4 minutes up, when's 3 minutes up. And it, in the end, I could go out and do a set of 5 minutes and almost get to the same spot every time, knowing when to stop without looking at my watch. You know, very rarely it would be, you know, 3:20. Usually it was like 4:52 or 4:58 or even 5:03 sometimes, you know. And there were periods in my career where I trained with other people. You know, when I was at Lynham, we had a good Greek group at Lynham. Bob Wallace was our coach. There's probably six or seven of us. This was very early on in my running career. Then, you know, it was 20, 21, 22. We just did what Bob Wallace did. You know, he wasn't coaching us per se, but if Bob was going out on a Tuesday for a set of 5 minutes, then half a dozen of us turn up at the gym and change and run with it. It's hard to explain. Like, the world records came probably at the right time in my running career, but people don't understand it was 15 years of hard work before that to get there. You know, I remember doing a clinic one time and somebody asked, my question is, I'm doing the US Olympic trials in 3 months' time. Can you write me a program? Or I want to qualify for the Olympic trials. Can you write me a program? I said, I could write you a 10-year program, but I can't write you a 3-month program. Everything fell into place throughout my career. But it was because of that, not easy isn't the right word, because when you first start, everything is hard. And then you have a little break. So, geez, you know, I remember trying to break 4 minutes for 1500, and I ran like a 3:59. And the next half a dozen was 4:03, 4:05, 4:07, 4:06, 4:02. And my coach was going, you know, you should be running faster than that. You know, the training you're doing and everything. And then I went in and ran for the Air Force against Midland Counties, Birmingham and the Bristol maybe. And I went from 3:59 to 3:47. But it was just a result of the hard work I did, you know. Yeah, you want to run fast. You want to consolidate the training you've done and the results you've had. There's no expectation of, like today, and I know this because I coach, is everybody wants a PR every time they run, a PB. And if they're 10 seconds behind over 5K or something, they're devastated. And sometimes, you know, you could be 25 seconds slower than your best. I've done it myself, you know, 13, 18, and the next one, 13, 32. You know, when you're thinking, how did that happen? But to me, it's always just about competing, beating people. The times come. You don't have to try and plan for those times. Yeah, you want to plan for the event. You know, it could be the 3As, it could be Welsh 3As, it could be UK Championships. You want to be able to run hard and run fast on those days. you know, when you're running against Mike McLeod and Nick Rose and Jeff Smith, you're running to beat them. You're not running to run.
Yeah, absolutely. One switch we did want to ask you about was, I guess, steeplechase to the marathon, because you were, I guess, 8:32 chase is, I mean, even today, it's still pretty fairly swift time. Man, I believe, or was it a few world champs ago, but the world champ standard for the steeple was still 8:30 in the UK, probably only 5 or 6 years ago now. But you decided to make the switch to the roads. Why was that? Talk about that decision. And obviously, like you said, it paid off for you, that hard work, and then a switch to marathon run.
I think 77 was the first time. 76, 77 was the first time I dabbled with the steeplechase. I don't mainly because we didn't have a steeplechaser at the station I was at. Mm. Steve, can you do that? And the 5,000 or that and the 1,500. And I think I got to 8:47 or something like that. And then there was aspirations of making a team for the Commonwealth Games in 1978. Winter of 77, leading into 78, I got pretty sick with some chest infection disease, or Bonham's disease, I think it was called. I missed quite a bit of the winter. So coach decided, and I was going to do, I got my years mixed up. So 77, I switched from the steeple to 5K to make the Commonwealth Games in 78. So made the Commonwealth Games. I ran 1500 and the 5000 there. Then for the Olympics in 80, I was going to run the 10,000. But because I'd been sick in 79 and 80 winter, Bob decided, I don't think you've done enough training for the 10,000, so we'll go back to the steeplechase. And that's why in 1980 was the last year I did the steeplechase. It wasn't pretty watching me do the steeplechase. I finished fourth in the Olympic trials. So I didn't make the team. Well, anyway, at the end of that season, was the 3/8 10,000, and I finished second behind Nick Rose, and with the second fastest time in the country, I think. I had the fastest, I think I had the second, 1980. I could be wrong. Lo and behold, I got picked to do a Far East tour, the Eight Nations game in Tokyo and in Beijing. I ran second in the 5,000 in Tokyo behind Kova. He was a young kid then, so was I. I was only 25 myself, but he just came on the scene and he kicked me down the home straight. And then in Beijing, I'd won the 10,000 and I won it. So it was 1980, it was really the opening the floodgates of performances and moving forward in the sport. Mm. But my steepling wasn't pretty. Maybe I should have stuck to the 10,000 in 1980 for the trials, because the steeple actually showed me I wasn't strong enough after being sick for the winter. I think, you know, with a 7:49 flat, 8:32 steeple doesn't equate. You know, it should have been an 8:20 something steeple, or maybe even lower than that. I just couldn't focus, concentrate for that 3K jumping over, starting again, jumping over here and starting again. I wasn't a good technician. Not like Roger Hackney was one of the best. John Bycourt probably was the best technician. Mm. I wasn't anything like that. I could beat them on flat, but I couldn't beat them on the barriers.
So you turned to flat, you're competing over 10,000. I believe you went to LA as well, LA Olympics,
yeah,
which is obviously around the corner now. It's going to be the next games.
And it's going to be there again now.
This is it. So any fond memories from LA, just being, I guess, being on that team with Cohen Ovette, and what the British team was like at that championship and what your experience was?
It was great, because I'd gone to the World Championships in 83 in Helsinki, and everybody kind of thought that the World Championships was going to take over from the Olympics. And they did a great job there in Helsinki. And it really seemed like that was going to be a fact. But when I got to LA and experienced the Olympics, there's nothing like it. The journey of getting there was probably harder than the races themselves, because as you probably know, nothing is simple or easy with the British board. And they made it as difficult as they possibly could for any of us, really, to make the team. The Olympic trials was in Cumbrian. Nick Rose won the trial. I was second. But they were only picking the first guy from the trial, so I had to run another 10K, which was the 3A's at Crystal Palace. And I won that, beating Mike McLeod. So I had to do an extra 10K to get in the team. So did Mike, by the way. And they were probably, and we were the first three at the real trial anyway. Nick won it, I was second, and I think Mike McLeod was third. And then we'd get to the 3A's, I won it, and Mike was second. The same three guys were in the mix all along. But the board just wouldn't have it. You know, they just said, no, we're only picking the winner from the official trial, and then we'll pick the other two from different races. Of course, everybody was running all over Europe and looking for 10,000s to run. When we had the 3A's coming up the middle of July, I think it was, or end of June. I won that, and like I say, so everything was a little tougher, a little harder to make the team than it is actually to run in Olympics. I don't know why they do that, but at least they didn't make us pay our way. So you have my finger on the pulse there.
Yeah, for sure.
The Olympics was great. It was really good to be part of it. I roomed with Nick Rose. He and I, we roomed in Helsinki the year before with Stevie Gins. And we had a great time. Nick being the veteran, had previously been to the Olympics, run all over the world kind of thing. It was good to hang on his coattails and see how he held himself, you know, how he controlled his effort and controlled his feelings, I suppose. I did learn a lot from Nick.
Of atmosphere throughout your career, was that one of the pinnacles? We can only watch pictures and some videos, but the atmosphere in that Coliseum did look rather special.
In LA,
yeah.
Yeah, it was. It was special because we had some superstars in our team. You know, Seb was there, Steve Ovett was there, Steve Cram, Daley Thompson, you know, and I was just a journeyman runner from Ebbw Vale, you know, who made the Olympic team. Like, they wasn't in their class kind of thing. And even today, you know, when I see them or talk to them, I have that feeling of inferiority, you know, because they're legends. You know, I was just a distance runner from Newport Harriers. So, yeah, the atmosphere was pretty good. Mm. Just good, you know, with the camps, the campuses, you know, for visiting athletes and stuff. You know, the food was great, location was great. You know, not too far from Santa Monica. You know, we were staying at Westwood Village UCLA campus. It was good, and it was the first time I'd been to America before, twice, and it was the first time I actually. You go into a race and then you race and you come home. You know, it was the first time I actually spent, you know, 2 weeks in America at that point anyway. Mm. It was good to absorb it all. And it helps you build up that experience level as well, you know, so you know how to handle the stress and the pressure and everything. But although it wasn't a huge amount on me because there's no expectations, you know. My expectations were to go there and run as hard as I could and run as well as I could.
Just in terms of, I guess, your relationship with other British athletes around that time, because I feel like these days, particularly because you don't seem to have to run the British champs always and the 3A's and things aren't so much of a big event on the circuit. People don't race their county champs anymore. They don't race the Southerns, the Welsh champs, etc. What was your relationship like with the guys on the circuit? Because you were racing them regularly, like you mentioned people in there that you're racing them on a weekly basis. So what was your relationship like with them outside of running? Because I think these days it's easy for athletes to, they're all pally, they pretend to be mates, but they only meet once a year at the British champs anyway. So
it's interesting that you should ask that question, because I was a prolific racer. Mm. You know, I would run for the Air Force, I'd run for my club, I'd run for Wales, I'd run for Great Britain. And sometimes it'd be every weekend for like 4 or 5 months at a time. And then be midweek races for the Royal Air Force then as well. But, you build up a lot of the respect and admiration you have for your competitors comes from reading AW every week. Nick Rose did this, or Brendan did that, or Tony Simmons did something, or Rooney Ford, or Ian Stewart, you know. So you build up that knowledge of these people, and you accept it, I suppose, and build up your own perception of what they're like. And then you actually meet them. I spend 2 weeks at Commonwealth Games or European Championships or World Championships or Olympics living in the same room as them. So you've got all this information, you admire them, and then you kind of bond them, and you're friends for life. You know, it's when you toe that starting line, you're not friends. You know, right up to the start line, you're friends, and right after the finish line, you're friends. You know, and it's all built on respect, I think, for each other because of our lifestyle, in terms of we're racing all the time, every weekend or sometimes twice a week we're racing, not always against the same people, but you know, I think we did a good job of spreading the word and kind of bringing everybody together. The race that Tony was in on one page, and the next page of race Brendan was in, or Ian Stewart was in, or Crammy, or Steve Ovett, or Nick Rose, or myself. And you're kind of looking at, I wonder how I would have done it that way. So I wonder how I would have done it that way. Then probably 4 or 5 times a year, you're actually pitted against each other. And it's always pretty exciting, you know, unless you're having a really bad run. But for the most part, even when you have a bad run, we were able to pull something out of the hat, you know. So it didn't seem, there's always positives to be pulled from every race. I was always very good at that. You know, okay, Nick beat me by 30 seconds. Then I'd roll my eyes and I'd go home and train. And then wait till I meet up with him again. I remember Brendan Foster coming down to Cardiff to do the May Day road races. And I had just run, I think, 8:03, 3K, maybe on the Wednesday before. We were running around. I was chasing him. I didn't beat him. He beat me by about 7 seconds, I think. And we were cooling down. He goes, "Hey, did you run that 3K Wednesday night?" I said, "Yeah." He said, 8:03. I said, "Yeah." He said, "I wouldn't have come down here if I'd known that." He probably didn't want a hard race, you know. If I mean, beat me handily in the end. But it was nice to know that he's got an eye out as well.
Mm.
No, Steve Jones, he's not running that badly. In fact, one of the first races he commentated on was, it was really big back in the day. It was the Mike Sully cross-country race. I think they have it again now in Bristol. It used to be at the Fry's or Cadbury's factory fields. And he was talking through the race, and it came, I think I finished like fifth or something like that. And it's Stan Jones, he said. This is 1977. And every time I saw, even today, you still say, "Hey, Stan, how you doing?" Because then nobody knew who I was here, which is the best way, I think.
I'm intrigued. That fuel, that competitive fuel, where you're actually training to beat people. Like you said, you'd do a race, Nick Rose would do you over, you'd go away, and that would motivate you. I just feel like that doesn't happen so much anymore. You know, everyone's just so fixated on themselves. And you mentioned earlier about, yeah, everyone's trying to run 27:30. No one's going away and training and, you know, working on a plan to beat one another as such. I think that's a bit of a shame, but it's where the sport's at. Talking of times,
it's all about time trial now. It's not. I mean, they're running very fast, mm-hmm. but it's like you got one guy in front, you got 7 guys following him. You know, mm-hmm. there's nobody rubbing shoulders and you know, giving a dig in the ribs or
yeah,
I've seen happen. You know, but it's very clinical today. I got to admit, I probably in the last 10 years probably watched 3 hours of track and field or athletics on the TV. It didn't interest me at all because it's so far removed from where I'm from my sport and what we did. Can't get excited. I go to marathons with people that I coach, and I don't get excited. You know, I'm excited when they run well and they got their PRs and stuff, but I wouldn't go out on the course to watch it. Anybody, I wouldn't. Probably most of the running I'd watch on TV has been in the VIP room at Boston Marathon or Chicago Marathon or in a bar in New York, you know.
It's a fair comment. You know, I do feel like that to a degree the excitement has been lost, and hey, that's what I guess Grand Slam this weekend are trying to bring back.
I don't know anything about the Grand Slam, but let me ask you a question. And what do you think is missing from it? Are you still excited by what's happening in the sport today? Go on.
Yeah. We have this debate a lot ourselves, you know, and I think Matt, you kind of, I think you get more interested by the times than I do necessarily. But even we were talking after the European indoors and just some of the racing, like you say, it's just lacks emotion, and it lacks people really making moves. And even go back to 2012, say Olympics, you still had it then a bit. You still had some of these great races, but I think particularly since 2020, it's really lost some of that. But so essentially Grand Slam this weekend is trying to bring pros together, and where it's all about racing, forces them to do two events. So we're hoping that's going to be the change we need, but it's so difficult to predict, isn't it?
But the agenda of events isn't fair to everybody. You know, because there's no 10,000, or there's, you know, it's probably only a 3,000, not 5,000. And the next one might not have a mile in it, or might not have 800s in it. You know, it's sad to see, you know, being a distance runner myself, you know, they're thinking of not having the 10,000 in the Olympics. Mm. How can you have an Olympics? There's a whole class of athletes there that you're totally ignoring. Mm-hmm. It'd be like saying there's no marathon. How could you have an Olympics with no marathon? I understand we're having a Commonwealth Games with no marathon next year, right? Because in Scotland next year, and I think they cut the marathon out of the program.
Yeah, they've had to shrink the timetable a bit because I guess it's last minute, etc. Logistics.
Yeah, that's understandable. The marathon isn't a huge logistical nightmare to organize, and they have a Glasgow marathon anyway. They could use the same course.
I think you are right, and yeah, Ollie mentioned, we do have this debate a lot about the sport and how gripping and exciting it is, these duels. It's much harder to follow. I think one of the reasons it's become harder to follow, though, is there's a lot more, well, I obviously I wasn't alive back then, but there seems to be a lot more depth of people running fast. So there's always a different face. Whereas, so you can never really get this bonded connection with certain athletes that you would see running 6, 7, 8 times a year. Because there's always someone new challenging. Like every single year, it kind of changes at the moment, which I think is difficult as a fan.
There's no, I'm as far removed from the sport, especially in the UK, as anybody could be. I mean, it seems to me there's no role models.
Yeah, that's fair.
There's nobody for the average club runner. Okay, they see him run on TV, or they might see him run an imitation road race or something like that, you know, once or twice a year, but they can't identify with these people. When I say these people, I don't even know myself. But they can't identify with it because all they're seeing, it's like watching actors on TV. You know, yeah, oh, he's a great actor, I like him. Or she's a great actor. That's as close as you get to them. It's just an imaginary, okay, you might go to the track and watch a track event, but you're not within arm's reach of them. It's not like you can approach them and talk to them and say, see you down at the Christmas pudding 5K on Boxing Day, you know, because you're never going to see them, you know.
So you're alluding to the fact that the best in the world, the best in the country, they're not training down at their local club anymore. They're not inspiring that wider community. They're, you know, training in remote places, and they're so dialed in. And like you mentioned earlier, clinical about their training. They're not interacting with anyone else.
And they don't need to be, you know. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's shoe sponsors. They should be saying, look, you're getting X amount of money. We need you at these amount of races every year. You can pick them, but we need you exposure. You know, nowadays exposure is on social media, not going out and doing events and racing against each other. And if I owned a running a shoe company, that would be the top of the list in the contracts. You have to run 10 times a year, you know, do a certain amount of A races in America or around the world. If you're going from Olympics to World Championships to Commonwealth Games to European Championships, your fan base isn't, there's no connection to you. You know, our fan base was the clubs, because we belong to a club and we competed for the club week in, week out. They don't do that today.
On that then, obviously back in your day when it was happening and when you were training down the club, let's chat about that Chicago Marathon, the world record. So that was the first marathon you finished. What was the, I guess, response like to the fact that, like you say, you're an athlete who was still competing for their club, even though you were going to the Olympics and doing things like that. But what was the response like coming back with a world record? And did you ever imagine you would run that quick?
No. Some people had said, Jonesy, when you run a marathon, I think you can run pretty quick. No. Bernie Plain from Cardiff. Mike Rowland is my coach from Newport Harriers. No, they all knew. Because they saw me racing week in, week out. We were friends. We'd been on teams together, traveling halfway around the world, world championships and cross country and stuff. Jonesy, I think even around this time, that time, I didn't even think about it. You know, in 1983, I ran Chicago and dropped out at 16 miles. Mm. I had something like $1,200 per diem from the race. And I dropped out. I went back to the race director, Bob Bright. I said, "Hey, Bright, dropped out. Do you want the check back?" He says, "No, we don't do it like that. Just come back next year." So I went back next year and I got even less pretty the next year, but I broke the world record. I'm glad he didn't want his money back because I don't really cash a check. So it was about going to Chicago and beating the best in the world. Carlos Lopez, Smith, Rob DiCostello, Joe Enzo, a whole host of people. It was probably the most talented field outside of the Olympics, which was 3 or 4 months before that. And it was about beating those guys. I'd beaten Rob DiCostello in a cross-country race in England. I think it was the year before, in 83. Yeah, because when the world cross-country was in Gateshead, he came over to do 3 or 4 months training before that. Well, anyway. I just wanted to be competitive and beat those guys. So I knew after dropping out of 16 miles, which was the easiest 16 miles I'd ever run, but I was in so much pain with my foot injury that I picked up the night before the race, or the afternoon before. But anyway, I just wanted to beat those guys. I sat in the pack, sat in the pack, sat in the pack, and I'd get to did somebody surge and I'd be right on them. I didn't think of times at all. I remember we went through 10 miles in something like 47 minutes, I think, or 48 minutes. And I looked at the clock and I was thinking, I can't be right. I didn't feel like we were running that fast. I mean, of course, today it's not fast, but that's another story. So I turned to Rob. I said, "Rob, is that clock right?" He says, "What, are we running too slow?" I said, "No, I just wanted to know." And we just carried on, and we got to 16 miles. I breathed a sigh of relief because I knew I was going to make the finish and I was still feeling pretty comfortable. No leg soreness or anything like that. And Gabriel Kamau, he sprinted off at 19 miles. And I thought to myself, it's time to go now. So I sprinted off after him, caught him, and went straight past. And I never looked back, no idea what the time meant. Not even sure what the time was. Clock was still around, on the press truck. It didn't draw my attention because I was more focused on dropping the guys behind me. But we get to 23 miles, I think. And Chris Brasher the guy who started London Marathon, was on the press truck writing for The Guardian or Observer or something like that. And he leaned out over the press truck and said, "Steve, 2 more sub-5-minute miles and you've got the record." I thought he meant a course record, so I put my head down and carried on. It wasn't until I crossed the finish line. They ran 2:08:05. Yeah. I was about 200 meters away from the finish line. I could see 207 or something. Next 207, let's say 45. And I was trying to run as fast as 207, 46, 47, 48, 49. Trying to race the clock to the finish line then. But I had no idea it was anything other than a possible course record. I don't know if you've ever seen the tape, but I crossed the finish line and some press guy called on. He says, "Do you realize this is a world record in only a second marathon. And I said, yeah, it's only the first one I finished. Back home, everybody's laughing about that because I had a stronger Welsh accent then. So. But no, it was about the competition. My whole career is always about the competition, you know, never giving up and pushing and pushing and pushing. Up until that day, I was a journeyman runner. Yeah, I'd run for the club. It was 1500, steeplechase, 5K, 3K, 10K. I run on the roads, run cross country all over the place. And yeah, I was fairly successful, but I wasn't a sensation. I was just a journeyman runner. And then that day changed everything.
I've got two questions. So you started that race and you didn't know what the world record was. Is that correct? You had that's crazy. I don't know anyone.
I didn't even ever watch them.
Yeah, that's just very cool, to be honest.
I'd get kicked off the shit, wouldn't I?
Yeah, really would. What followed? You mentioned, you know, appearance fees that year prior and stuff. Did your life change overnight? How much money? I'm intrigued. Are you able to say how much money did you earn off of that win?
For that win, I think it was $35,000 from Reebok, breaking the record. $10,000 for a course record. I think it was $50,000 for a world record. I earned more money that day than I did in the previous 5 years. Previous 5 years of being in the Air Force.
Yeah.
Up until that day, I probably only ever earned, I'd say I earned less than, in a 10-year international career, I earned less than $10,000.
From right distance running. Yeah. Jesus.
It would be, you know, $200 a year or $300 yeah. there. You know, and it was always under the table in an envelope or stuff, whatever.
It's the way the sport works, right? One race can change.
I think it still happens.
Yeah.
I think, there's the advertised amount and there's a little bit under the table.
Yeah. Going forward then, were you able to, I guess, professionalize your training a bit more, or did you choose to? Because you mentioned before, obviously, you're working all the time. That sort of money would enable you not to, but did you make that decision to change your lifestyle?
It changed it in some ways. It didn't professionalize my training because I got to that point doing what I've been doing for 15 years almost, or 10 years, 12 years. So 14 years, actually. So I didn't need to train that, change that at all. I had to get an answering machine. I was getting invited to, and the Air Force, St. Athens, they loaned me an answering machine for a couple of months. Because the phone was going off all the time. I bought a car. My wife had a car already, but I didn't drive until I was 1985. So I was 30 before I started driving. I bought a car. We bought a house within a year. Lots of things changed. I was given a little bit more time off from work so I could train. You know, I didn't have to go in until 9 o'clock sometimes, or I could have an extended lunch break. The Air Force was no hardship at all. Once I broke the world record, they couldn't give me enough. I understood fully my responsibilities and their expectations of me and my job before I broke the world record. So, yeah, I'm not going to sit here and complain. No, I had to work all these hours. I had to do this. It's all part of who I was and what got me to that world record stage in 1984. Mm-hmm. And that's something else that changed, and it was within me. My personality didn't change, I think. It's not like I grew a big head all of a sudden, but I had this confidence in myself. You know, I still didn't like to answer the phone or pick the phone up or call somebody for something. I didn't like going on TV. I didn't like going on the radio. I didn't like doing podcasts. In my running life, my athletic life, I had this confidence where I felt I could win every race I ran in. I could have been in blocks next to Alan Wells. I felt I had a chance. I could beat him. Obviously, but that's the level of confidence I had in myself. Whether I was on the track starting 1500 meters or I was on the road doing a half marathon, I felt I could win those races. I suppose that's one of the characteristics you achieve when you get to that point.
Yeah.
Where you believe in yourself that you can do it.
Mm. It took a world record to start thinking like that.
I was lucky enough to do it twice, you know. And if you look at unlucky enough to miss it by 1 second in the marathon as well.
I think, it's cool. I think with London around the corner, we would love to touch on a few more of these races, because not all of your races went like that. And you made some classic mistakes. You've blown up in marathons before, and we'll get to that. But I guess we want to start with London in 85, 208, but you famously stopped for the toilet then, which is probably an issue a few might have in a couple of weeks.
Probably not at the same spot, though. I don't think they run past the tower on that side of the tower anymore. What do you want to know about London Marathon?
Well, you still won that race. So I guess what's going through your head in that moment, and how did the race unfold?
Well,
you still ran 208, which is mightily impressive.
I think one of the things that motivated me to run London in the first place was because Charlie was running. And Charlie was the golden boy. Well, actually, the bronze boy. He won the bronze medal in Los Angeles. And a couple of months later, we broke the world record. So we were pitted against each other. The north and south, you know, Charlie come from the north where they're all working cats, blue collar guys. Whereas I was from South Wales, I was in the Air Force, so I was probably more of a white collar guy. But the press did a pretty good job of matching us in terms of being opposites. Of course, it wasn't all how it seemed. Charlie worked for Nike. Charlie didn't have a real job, and that's what they were saying about me. I was in the Air Force, I didn't have a real job, I was getting all the time off I wanted. Which was further from the truth that anybody could ever understand. Though we were good friends, still are good friends, I hope. He and I were, like I said, pitted against each other. So that was a motivation. I ran in January that year, 3 months before London. I ran a cross-country race in Algoiba, northern Spain. And Alan Warner was my advisor and agent. To go to Algoiba, and I could just about fit into my Welsh running kit. I put on a few pounds. I wasn't very fit, and I'd already committed to London. So I ran the Algoiba, probably the third or fourth time I'd run there, and I was way down in the field, but 26 maybe, 13th or 26th. But anyway, Alan took a picture, and he sent it to me when I got home, and there's this fat guy in a Welsh uniform running round Algoiba. So Alan says, Jonesy, you've got 3 months to London, you better put your head down and start training. So I put my head down and trained. I had a couple of good results before London. I think I finished second behind Jack Buckner in the 3A's. I think it was a Gamers 10K in Battersea Park. So, and that was either a week or 2 weeks before London. So I knew I was fit again. And I wasn't going to do anything in the race. I was going to sit and watch Charlie as long as I could stand it. The race was perfect. It was a perfect pace. I think it was pretty good weather as well. It was Charlie and myself, Alistair Hutton, from Norway, I think he is, Denmark, a couple of other guys, and we were tussling away. And Charlie was always had his eye on me. And of course, I had my eye on him. We get to 20 miles and 10K to go. It's a 20-mile run with a 10K road race. I put my head down and started stretching it out. And I think one by one, everybody else dropped off. At about 19 miles, I said to Charlie, I said, Charles, I'm dying to go to the bathroom. My stomach's killing me. And Charlie, I always call him Charles. And Charlie goes, stop. So I did. And I stopped and relieved myself. And I think he thought he was away then, but I caught him within 600 meters. And we came to Blackfriars Tunnel, went under the tunnel together, and I came out 10 seconds ahead of him. And the race was over then. My philosophy going into the race was all I had to do was stick with Charlie 20 miles because I knew I could beat him over 10K, which wasn't very respectful, but that's how I felt, you know. And it turned out that Charlie wouldn't shake my hand at the finish because I'd gone to the bathroom. Charlie ran 208.30, I think, 208.32 that day, which was an English record for many years, I think. So it just worked out, you know. I knew Charlie couldn't beat me over 10K, so all I had to do was stick with him for 20 miles.
Yeah.
And he knows that, you know.
Sounds like.
he knows that that's what my philosophy was. That was my race tactic, I suppose.
I think you made a toilet stop work in your favour. You know, you stopped, and then the minute you caught him, his head's going, "What, really?" And he's blown up.
That's what he did, yeah. I suspect he knew I had stopped to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
He didn't think I was going to come back. And it's toilets a funny thing, because a lot depends on your philosophy, I suppose, your mental picture of the outcome of the race. I knew that I could win, but nothing that happened in the race was going to deter that, or was going to turn me away from that positive thinking, and it didn't. But I've been in other races where I've had the same situation, where I've had my doubts about whether I could win the race or whether he's even fit enough to be in the race. And I've had to stop to go to the toilet, and it's all gone out the window then. You know, so it depends if on your own positive feelings, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
There's some races are disasters for the same, and they were disasters for the same reason that other races were positive results and positive endings.
Yeah, for sure. And those first three kind of like marathon years, obviously apart from the one that you DNF the year before, you got three wins in three majors across 3 years. You obviously broke the world record. You then won London the year after, as you've just said, and then 86, the UK record in Chicago, 207, just shy of the world record. But that's the one that was unmatched for nearly 30 years.
Right. Years.
Yeah, 30 years, which is absolutely staggering when you consider the developments that were made in that time in terms of training, scientific understandings of that training, and of course, kind of the change in technology and shoe technology as well. But how do you think it lasted so long? Were you almost waiting for someone to break it all those years, or were you sat quite happy thinking, actually, I think I'm okay, you know?
Well, a bit of both, really. It's I think the result in that time was testament to how well I ran.
Mm.
You know, how well other people are running, or how bad they're running, because they weren't getting close to it, and they weren't. People think that they're not as good. You know what I mean? They're probably 5K times quicker than mine. They're 10K times quicker than mine, but they just didn't perform at the marathon, and that's what the marathon's about. It tests you. It's a great test. Like I say, the more talented runners than me were trying to run faster than I ran in the marathon. They could do it cross country or on the track or on the shorter distance on the road. I don't think they had the belief in themselves, because it's a testing event. You know, I don't know if you run marathons, but it catches you out. It catches you out, and you only have to have one little bit of weakness, and it all goes out the window. In 85, when I went back to Chicago and I ran the 207, well, I think there were three Brits in the race. It was me, Jeff Smith, and Mick Hurd. Mick Hurd was a master then, a veteran. In 85, there must have been 10 or 12 Brits. Top Brits, Dave Clark, Mickey McLeod, myself, Mick Hurd again, and a whole host of other people. Oh, Jonesy ran 208 here last year. It must be an easy course. There's nothing easy about the marathon, whether it's the course or whether it's the 26.2 miles. There's nothing easy about it. I'm not even sure if any of them finished. I'd have to go back and look at the results from 85, but there were a couple of guys in the top 10, I think. Jeff Smith might be one of them. If you're not 100% confident, they shouldn't have gone there thinking, if Jonesy can do that, then what can I kick his ass and everything else. Why wouldn't I get a fast time in the marathon, I think? But it's all about having a plan, being confident about your plan and going for it, you know. And I think those years, those lean years of UK marathon runners, not to say we didn't have good marathon runners, you know, because in those lean years, you had Steve Brace, you had Damon Martin, you had Paul Evans, Paul Davis Hale, you know, who won Chicago himself in 86, I think, I'm not sure. But you had them, but either they weren't getting in the right races, or they had the wrong plans, the wrong tactic. Because if you get something wrong, the marathon is the only event that'll catch you out. And I've been caught out many times, more times than I've had wins. You know, I've had good results, but not wins. But I've had some bad results where you wonder what, where the hell you're doing it. Go back to sprinting.
I think you talk about the psychology and being prepared and having that self-belief in your preparation and stuff as well. I just want to touch on it just a little bit more detail for, I think the listeners would be very interested to hear actually what that kind of training was like. You know, how many miles a week were you running? What was like a key session before Chicago that you got done in order to get yourself in world record shape?
Remembering the course that I wasn't, world record wasn't on my mind. I wasn't trying to do these workouts to get in world record shape. I was trying to get in the best shape I could. So go back to the world record in 84. The longest workout I did would have been 4 times 5 minutes or what? 10 times 3 minutes. There was no 10 minute hard or there was no 30 minute tempo because all, as I said, just now, all my running was tempo running. You know, and I do 3 workouts a week plus a fartlek workout. Now, over here, tempo is a workout. Or fartlek is one of your, it could be your 5 minute sessions or it could be your 3 minute sessions. To me, they were two different entities. They were on top of my workouts. But I was just trying. I just come back from the Olympics. I had another journeyman result. I took a couple of weeks easy, I suppose. I still run in a few more beers. Nick Rose and I enjoyed drinking in the Westwood Village Tavern, so Baxter's Bar, I think it was called. We got back from the Olympics, back to Wales, and put my head down and started training again. Because I knew I had Chicago coming up. I just needed a break from the track and from all the racing I had done. So I just put my head down, and I was still doing the same workouts. I was coaching myself at that point. I was doing the same workouts, same mileage, same distance long run, which was a maximum 18 miles. And I don't think I got over 90 miles in that period, like 90 miles a week. But it was quality. Everything was always quality. Even my easy runs were quality because you're always trying to pick positives out of what you're doing. And then I went to a month before, maybe 3 weeks before, we went to Park City, Utah to train at altitude for a little while. And it wasn't because I felt I needed altitude training. The guys that run at altitude all race well here, race well there. I went to altitude because Chicago Marathon was paying 4 tickets for me, my wife and 2 boys, to go to Park City to train for Chicago Marathon. There was no ulterior motive other than it'd be nice to go there. It's just good. My results from training at altitude were secondary, I suppose, as opposed to actually being there, living in Burger King and McDonald's for 3 weeks with my kids. And then I got to Chicago. Like, I did a couple of races there in the States. I ran a 15K. Actually, I ran a 10K somewhere. I can't remember how I did. I might have won it, actually. And then I did a 15K in Texas, in El Paso, Texas. And Carlos was there. And Carlos beat me by about 13 seconds. It was a 15K. Great race. It's funny because we'd run across the border into Mexico from El Paso. And you probably have 3,500 people running over the border and 5,500 people coming back into the States with handwritten numbers on and working boots instead of running shoes. But it was funny. So I knew Carlos was pretty fit again. Whether he had the stamina to run another marathon so close to the Olympic marathon, I'm not sure how much training he had done. In fact, he was training here in Boulder, and we were in Park City. We got out of Park City. I think he got snowed in here for a couple of days before he got to Chicago. It was the anticipation of running against him. Obviously, I've run against Carlos dozens of times, maybe a half a dozen times. So I knew them. I knew how they ran. And I knew the people, you know, Jeff Smiths and Joe Enzos and the other guys in the race. So I knew I could handle them. But whether I could beat them was another thing, but I knew I could handle what they had. I think I explained earlier, it was a big pack. We got to 16 miles, so relief. Gabriel Camau took off at 19 miles. Actually, at 18 miles, we took a left-hand turn And on that turn was a water station, feed station. And Gabriel kind of cut right across Jeff Smith and I. Jeff Smith caught his heel. Gabriel went down and Jeff was just like windmilling, trying not to fall over. And I just caught him by the arm. I said, okay. So I was aware of everything that was going on around me. I wasn't stressed. I wasn't hurting. I just caught his arm, stopped him from falling on his face. Gabriel picked himself up, caught us up, and then went straight past, and I just followed him. Deacon Stiles said he didn't think I'd keep it up, and he was surprised I kicked it in at that point. He didn't think I'd keep it up, so he didn't go after me, which might have changed it, who knows. Mm. And it was the same the year after, in 85. It was Deke and a couple of Djiboutians, and I just wanted to be Deke. Deke was the guy, you know, he was the purest, the marathon purist, I suppose. And I don't think he ever broke 28 minutes over 10K on the track, but he ran 207 for a marathon.
Pretty good ratio. I think before we finish, we'll ask about your fueling because, in this day and age, I think many would laugh. Nutritionists would have a heart attack. Is it, are the rumors true? Were you living off pie, beers and Coca-Cola?
I have a picture up on the wall there, the diet of a champion, Mars bars, Coca-Cola and meat pies. We're working class people, you know, trying Iberville. My wife's from Iberville as well, you know, hamburgers and chips and, you know, chips, beans and an egg or chips, beans and something else. You know, it's my diet would be legendary, I suppose. And it doesn't resemble anything. It doesn't resemble anything like how we eat today. But certainly doesn't resemble anything how, when I say we, us as a family here, it doesn't resemble anything that your top athletes are living off today. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't even know. You know, I got some running cookbooks here, some runners that have published cooking books and bakery books and what I had before, like for breakfast before the race. It used to make me smile because you do clinics, you know, and what should I eat tomorrow morning before the race? You wouldn't eat what I probably eat. everybody thinks there's a secret. You know, it's in the shoes, the training, the diet. Whatever, there's no secret. There might be more secrets today than there were in my day. And it's sport today is unrecognizable in my mind.
Yeah. And what's crazy is that the times, whilst they have come on, they're not a whole lot quicker than what you guys ran, for sure.
Well, actually, I mean, if you pulled up
from a British perspective.
Yeah.
But I do see a change in that. You know, there's a curve going upwards. It's interesting to see. There's a couple of guys now who run faster than I have. So it's interesting to see the other results, you know, half marathons and 10Ks and stuff like that from the same people. It'd be a shame if they're not spreading the word, you know, around the clubs by competing against other guys from different clubs or competing for a club. You know, a lot of them compete for Nike or for Puma or for Saucony or Adidas, not so much Reebok anymore. There's no common touch anymore. And I think that's what I had, that common touch, you know, where I could sit down after a cross-country race and sign, you know, 100 autographs or, you know, 50 pictures and stuff like that. You don't see that anymore. You barely see it in golf now, you know, just trying to isolate themselves, I think.
Well, we'd love you to write a runner's cookbook.
It's on his wall. It's on his wall. So three things.
We can, we'd love you to get that out. But look, anyway, I think great place to end. And Steve, thank you so much for chatting to us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.